Headlines: Russia says it backs Iran's position in the talks on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal, calling on the U.S. to return to the original accord. China holds the second day of its largest ever military drills around Taiwan amid rising tensions following the U.S. House Speaker's visit to the island. And Israel has closed its crossing with the Gaza Strip, further tightening its blockade of the territory. We have a report. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. The Russian foreign ministry has backed Iran's position on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal, known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. Sergei Lavrov says Iran's demands for an agreement based on the JCPOA is absolutely legitimate. Lavrov argued that Washington should return to the original accord. He said the U.S. must recall that it unilaterally pulled out of the deal in 2018 and try to fulfill what it had committed to. The top diplomat also said Russia's position on the revival of the JCPOA remains unchanged. Moscow wants the pact to be restored in the form that was approved by the U.N. Security Council with no amendments or exemptions. Iran's deputy foreign minister and top negotiator has held talks in Vienna as part of negotiations to revive the JCPOA. Ali Bagharikani held talks with the European Union coordinator Enrique Mora. Prior to that, he met with Russia's envoy, Mikhail Yulianov. The top Iranian negotiator is leading a delegation who arrived in the Austrian capital earlier on Thursday to resume talks to restore the pact. The JCPOA was derailed after Washington withdrew from it in 2018. The remaining parties have held several rounds of talks since April last year, but the negotiations came to a halt in March due to what Iran calls the U.S. failure to show goodwill, as well as its excessive demands. China begins the second day of its largest ever military drills around Taiwan amid rising tensions over the self-ruled island. The Chinese military says the exercises involve a conventional missile firepower assault in waters to the east of Taiwan. Taipei says Chinese fighter jets and ships cross the median line that runs down the Taiwan Strait and describe the move as highly provocative. The drills kicked off a day after U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi concluded her trip to Taiwan. China says the war games work as a countermeasure in the face of provocations by the U.S. and its allies in Taiwan. Washington, however, calls the drills a gross overreaction to Pelosi's visit. On Friday, Pelosi, in a press conference, said Washington will not allow China to isolate Taiwan.
They may try to keep Taiwan from visiting or participating in other places, but they will not isolate Taiwan by preventing us to travel there. We've had high-level visits, senators in the spring, a bipartisan way, continuing visits, and we will not allow them to isolate Taiwan.
Pelosi said Washington would continue its support for Taiwan. The House Speaker, however, said her trip was not aimed at changing the status quo in the island. Relations between Washington and Beijing have hit a new low over Taiwan. China has responded by announcing sanctions against Pelosi. Beijing also said that it was ending cooperation with Washington over a host of issues. Some include climate change and anti-drug efforts. China sees Taiwan as part of its territory and has already warned Washington against playing with fire, vowing to punish those who anger Beijing. A UN draft report says North Korea is preparing for additional nuclear tests, at the same time working towards the production of a key ingredient for nuclear weapons. A panel of experts has submitted a report to the UN Security Council saying that it has observed that North Korea has started to dig new tunnels at Pyongyang site. It says Pyongyang has reconstructed support buildings at the site. According to the report, the new changes at the site can pave the way for Pyongyang to conduct its seventh test for developing nukes. The report also reveals North Korea has been boosting its capabilities to produce nuclear fissile materials at a major nuclear complex. North Korea says its nuclear activities are for self-defense and aimed at deterring regional threats. Israel has closed its crossing with Gaza, further tightening its inhumane blockade on the territory that has been in place since 2007. According to analysts, the ongoing closure of the crossing will further decrease the already low standards of living in the tiny seaside territory. Ashraf Shannon reports.
The Israeli regime has sealed its crossings with the Gaza Strip since Tuesday, further exacerbating the humanitarian situation in the impoverished territory. Currently, there are two Israeli-controlled crossings into the tiny coastal territory, the Kerem Shalom commercial crossing, located on the southernmost tip of the Gaza Strip, and the Erez pedestrian crossing in northern Gaza. The crossings have been partially operating since Israel imposed a tight blockade on Gaza in 2007.
The Israel closure of the crossings for the third day has serious, severe implications on the lives of the Palestinians in Gaza Strip. We are calling on the international community for immediate actions to pressure Israel to lift the blockade in Gaza.
The impoverished coastal territory already suffers from high poverty and unemployment rates. Most Gazans also depend on handouts from international aid agencies to survive.
Closing the crossing point from the Israeli occupation, it's a collective punishment. It's part of blackmail against Palestinian people. Over 2 million people living in Gaza, they are living in the huge jail. The social and economic situation so deteriorated.
For 15 years, the Israeli regime has kept an illegal and inhumane closure on the Gaza Strip, affecting the lives of more than 2 million Palestinians and restricting their freedom of movement. Tel Aviv's move to shut down the crossings will further complicate living conditions in the impoverished territory. According to human rights groups, the Israeli blockade has wreaked havoc on the economy of Gaza and worsened its humanitarian conditions. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
A former Twitter employee is being tried in the U.S. for handing over personal information to Saudi Kingdom. Ahmad Abu Amo allegedly traded user data for $100,000 and an expensive watch. It was revealed that the defendant was in close contact with a top advisor of the Saudi Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman. Abu Amo was arrested in 2019 on a number of charges, including being an illegal agent of a foreign government. Prosecutors accuse him of being enlisted by Saudi officials between 2014 and 2015 to get private information on accounts, firing off posts critical of the regime. The ex-Twitter employee faces 20 years in prison if convicted of charges. Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan has vowed to continue his efforts to overthrow what he calls the country's U.S.-backed imported government. He has demanded that the Pakistani Chief Election Commissioner step down to pave the way for holding fresh elections for the country. Nasser Kazmi reports.
Hundreds of supporters and lawmakers of the Pakistani Tehreek-e-Insaf party has filled the streets of the capital Islamabad in a show of support for the ousted Premier Imran Khan. They marched in Islamabad's red zone to protest the recent verdict issued by the country's electoral body that declared Khan's party has received illegal funds from foreign individuals and entities.
The charged protesters are not only demanding that Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif and his cabinet step down, but also warning the United States to stay away from Pakistan's internal affairs.
The demonstrators criticized the role of Washington in Pakistan's politics, saying they are seeking independent foreign policy in Pakistan.
What they are doing to us with the drone attacks, the army men who are killed in our country, they just went for the, you know, the relief work, and after that, the plane was crashed. It is just, I would say, It's, they're intervening in our country.
With USA, some black sheep from Pakistan, they were also involved into all this procedure. That's why the real hero of Pakistan, Imran Khan, has to resign from his office. And now the question is why? Because Imran Khan, he said absolutely not to all their illegal and to all their unfair demands.
While addressing the protesters, Khan underlined that a fresh election is the only way to get rid of what he called the puppet regime.
The U.S. staged a scripted drama for their own benefit in Pakistan and brought like-minded people into the power to control Pakistan and its foreign policy. So fresh elections are the only solution to get rid of this government.
On the other hand, the Pakistani government has filed a disqualification reference in Election Commission against Imran Khan. The government demands that the electoral body impose a lifetime ban on former premier as well as his political party. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
The Ukraine war has changed the world order, and one of the reasons behind that is the fallout between Russia and the West. One organization says Russia's cooperation with the West is essentially now over. Russia says it would never trust the West again. The key question is who will be left behind or will suffer from this as a result.
The war in Ukraine has created massive political and geostrategic shifts in alliances at regional and international levels. The war has now brought back the specter of the Cold War to the global scene. Russia, which is at loggerheads with the United States and its Western allies, says the era of constructive cooperation between Russia and Western countries is irrevocably over. Moscow says the end of the partnership is regardless of the result of the war in Ukraine. Regardless of the duration and outcome of Russia's special military operation in Ukraine, we can already state now that the 30-year era of generally constructive, though not problematic, cooperation with the West is irrevocably over.
Well, in politics, nothing is definite and irreversible, as we well know. Certainly, the situation is deeply affected by the events and the stanch positions of either side, particularly the Western and the Russian side. So in the near future, which means in the forthcoming months, is not envisageable a reversal of the distancing that has been signaled by both Russia and the United States and Europe on the issue of Ukraine.
The Russian official added that the current crisis has provided a unique opportunity to get rid of, quote, residual illusions. He also added that Moscow will use the crisis to go beyond the paradigm of what he described as friendly absorption, which Moscow says has been produced over and over again since 1992. It refers to a climate in which dominant powers following the collapse of the Soviet Union promised Russia to accept it as a member of advanced Western developed nations.
The Ukraine war has changed the world order, and one of the reasons behind that is the fallout between Russia and the West. One organization says Russia's cooperation with the West is essentially now over. Russia says it would never trust the West again. The key question is who will be left behind or will suffer most as a result.
It's now a fact that the West and its allies are no longer the hegemon powers at the international stage. Following the war in Ukraine, the West imposed a raft of massive and unprecedented sanctions on Russia in a bid to weaken Moscow or to potentially make its economy collapse. The sanctions have hurt Russia's economy, but did not trigger its collapse. On the contrary, Russia's oil and gas revenues have soared over the past few months.
The Western side, with its approach, is also imposing a set of rules which are based on its own interests, although they pretend these rules to be universal. The rest of the world is instead proposing to identify shared rules which may differ in the practice according to the latitude and the cultural experience of the different societies. So this is the existential clash between the two sides.
It's now Western citizens who are paying higher gas and energy prices. The crisis has indeed negatively affected European and North American nations and their economies. It's now widely believed that the US has failed to create a united global front against Russia. The asymmetry of interests and perspectives between Washington and Moscow is unlikely to change anytime soon.
On this, we have to add the fact that the manufacturing capacity of the world has moved from the West to the East, particularly to the Far East, which is Asia. And this weakens considerably the perspectives of the West in long-term confrontation with the rest of the world.
And the latest spat between the United States and China over Taiwan is likely to further strain the relations between the Western-led bloc and the emerging counter-hegemonic alliance. Under these circumstances, emerging powers like Iran, with its vast energy sources and rising military might, can play a pivotal role in the shifting balances between the East and the West.
The United States has declared a monkeypox outbreak a public health emergency. The move will speed up the delivery of vaccines to curb the spread of the disease. The U.S. has reported over 6,600 monkeypox cases so far. A quarter of these cases have appeared in New York. The declaration comes amid reports that vaccines and treatments for monkeypox are in short supply across the U.S. Last month, the World Health Organization declared the outbreak a global health emergency. Monkeypox primarily spreads through close physical contact and generally causes a mild disease. However, it can be fatal and cause serious symptoms. And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is the text of the speech delivered on June the 28th, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of the top officials and employees of the judiciary. It is true that executive officers are effective, important agents, and they have certain powers. They have opinions about people and about cases. But the judiciary must act independently and not be influenced by their views. This is also one aspect. The other side of the issue is that these same officers sometimes have expert opinions, which are based on their research. These expert opinions should not be ignored. The judiciary should use these expert opinions, whether this is the police force, in the Ministry of Intelligence, or elsewhere. The officers who are present sometimes have professional, expert opinions. Pay attention to their opinions. Another issue is something that the officers often complain to us about. For example, they say that when they object that why hasn't a certain matter been dealt with, they are told that the matter has been dealt with. They are told, we gave it to the judiciary and the judiciary didn't do anything. So they ask the judiciary why they haven't done anything. They are told that a law about this case doesn't exist. But if you do not have a law about this matter, who should write that law? You must write it. Make a bill, write it. Give it to the Parliament to approve it for you. This should not happen that an officer struggles, makes an effort, does something, and then he comes to the judiciary and is ignored by them due to the negligence of the judiciary or a lack of expertise on the part of the judge in that particular case. In such a situation, his effort will be wasted. So this is the sixth point. A comprehensive approach of the relationship between the judiciary and the officers is needed.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The seventh point I would like to make is the issue of the psychological security of the people. This is a right of the people that I said I would talk about. The people have a right to psychological security. What does psychological security mean? It means every day a rumor, a lie, or a frightening statement should not be spread to people's minds. Only newspapers were doing such things until yesterday. Now the internet is doing this too. Once in a while, every few days, or sometimes every few hours, a rumor, a lie, or something bad is said by a specific person or an unknown person, and this is published on the internet. These statements worry people and ruin their minds. Some people tell a lie, or they spread a rumor. Well, the people will no longer have psychological security in such a situation. One of the duties of the judiciary is to deal with these instances. Of course, I have heard people say that we do not have a law about this. First of all, the existing laws can be used about this, and based on these laws, the related ruling can be reached. But if you do not have a law for a certain situation, quickly make a law. Of course, sometimes the judiciary itself is the source of some of this news. Sometimes a member of the judiciary mentions something about a person or organization, and his statements affect public opinion.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
True to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witch hunt.
Come here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
The U.S. military sector is struggling to recruit more personnel as the nation's youth are losing interest in joining the military. As a result, armed forces are experiencing large shortfalls in enlistments for various posts. Figures are representing a lack of enthusiasm among job seekers to join the Army, and it's never been this low since the time after the U.S. war in Vietnam back in 1975. However, the issue is not just related to a shortage of interest, as less than a quarter of young American adults are actually physically fit, and many others have criminal records disqualifying them to be enlisted.
U.S. military shortfalls.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and in today's episode, we'll focus on the U.S. military sector and its shortfalls in enlistment. Now, with interest to join the Army dwindling throughout the nation, U.S. Defense is trying hard to create incentives to hire staff necessary for its many operations. In today's show, we'll be joined by Jeremy Kuzmaroff, managing editor at Covert Action magazine Tulsa. And later in the program, we'll have Susan Banaszewski, activist at the Center for Political Innovation and member of the Minneapolis Anti-War Committee from Minnesota. Please stay with us.
The U.S. military forces have a large presence across the globe, considering U.S. adventurism worldwide. From the Middle East to South China Sea and Eastern Europe, American forces are present to support allies, take on Chinese and Russian spheres of influence, and act like the so-called leader of the free world.
In fact, according to official estimates, between 160,000 to 180,000 of American active duty personnel are stationed outside the United States and its territories to pursue the U.S. global agenda. After all, a lot of forces are needed to fill the roughly 750 U.S. foreign military bases, which spread across 80 countries. So what is the root cause of the lack of interest today among American youths in pursuing a career in the U.S. military?
I think the reason is because the U.S. has looked bad on the world stage in recent military interventions. You know, they invaded Iraq. The war was based on lies. It caused catastrophe for the Iraqi people. It was not a source of pride for the American people. Similarly, in Afghanistan, the U.S. fought there for 20 years, and ultimately the Taliban took over. And then there are these smaller scale military interventions like in Libya and Syria that have caused just more chaos and disaster for those countries and have not really yielded any success for the United States. And again, the motive is probably just crass economic materialism. So, I mean, why would a young person want to join the military if they're going to be sent into war, miles and miles for their home? That's not for self-defense. That's based on lies. That's for the greed of oil companies.
Now, multiple U.S. military and defense officials have recently come forward to leak the news. Every branch of the American military is struggling to meet its fiscal year 2022 recruiting goals. U.S. media investigations also corroborate statements as there is a record low percentage of young Americans eligible to serve or willing to consider it.
Well, I think Americans are ingrained from a young age, to worship the flag, and they say the Pledge of Allegiance in school, and they're kind of conditioned to be very patriotic. And I mean, that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, there are positive virtues of the United States. The U.S. Constitution has some good principles, including things like freedom speech, freedom of religion. But I think, again, increasingly Americans are weary of the excessive military spending and the, these foreign adventures. I mean, Americans also, was forged as a, in rebellion against an empire. And that's why the U.S. never announces itself as an empire.
The Pentagon's top leaders are therefore scrambling for new methods to find new recruits to fill out the ranks. However, the long drought for military recruiting does not appear to be shrinking in the very near future at all. Now, with only a short time remaining in the fiscal year, how is the U.S. Army's recruitment crisis panning out, considering the fact it's just met 40% of its recruitment goals?
Well, so I think it's pretty clear that there's a clear divide in the ruling class in America, with some more realistic elements of the defense system trying to make it clear that the U.S. is not equipped for a war, particularly a ground war. For example, retired Army colonel and former advisor to Secretary of Defense Douglas MacGregor is ringing the alarm bell for months that the U.S. Army doesn't have the numbers, the training, nor the equipment to be prepared for a war. I think it's becoming clear that the U.S. Army isn't going to be able to meet their goal. It's going to become clear in more and more ways that we are not equipped for any sort of all-out war. We're going to have to readjust our expectations of our military, and the government will need to stop writing checks that the military won't be able to cash.
Officially speaking, the U.S. military has been deployed to more than 200 countries and territories within the past 7 years. From South Korea, Japan, Vietnam, and West Germany in the earlier days, to Bahrain, Qatar, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen, the forces have been covering vast time zones to advance U.S. interests in different regions.
While I am an American and I don't have intimate knowledge of how other nations view the U.S. military, I think it would likely depend on that country's relation to the U.S. and the international order. Because as we can see right now in the NATO and U.S. proxy war against Russia and Ukraine, many European nations seem to see the U.S. military as the defense force for the West, or at least the U.S. military funding. But on the other hand, if for much of the world, most of the world who's not the direct ally of the U.S. and not European, I would view the presence of U.S. troops and the threat that the U.S. Army could come to your country as a constant threat and reminder that the U.S. does not hesitate to pursue regime change or other types of operations in their countries.
What implications does erosion of trust and interest in the U.S. military have for the American nation?
Well, I think there's a lot of anger in the country at the way the country had been governed. You know, the country had been misgoverned for at least two or three decades. I mean, since the war on terror started, you know, the U.S. government had invested trillions of dollars in military and wars that have not yielded any positive results for almost anybody. So there's a lot of anger towards the government, toward the elites in Washington.
An increasing number of young men and women are disqualified to join military ranks over obesity, drug use, or criminal records. Indeed, only 23% of Americans aged 17 to 24 are qualified to serve without a waiver to join, down from 29% in recent years.
Only about 30% of young Americans qualify for the military due to their health, mental health, drug use, or if they have a legal history.
And public attitudes are also changing dramatically against the pursuit of a profession in the military sector, not much to anyone's surprise. The emotional and psychological problems caused by serving in the military are among factors shifting the public opinion about a job in the U.S. military.
Well, the government invests billions of dollars every year in public relations to create a kind of cult of the military. And there's an office in the Pentagon devoted to Hollywood and to ensuring that scripts, you know, valorize the U.S. military and glorify the military. And that's a very powerful propaganda tool because it's insidious. People go to the movies for entertainment. They don't think they're watching propaganda or political film, but really they are being, in a sense, conditioned and brainwashed to valorize the military. So that does have an impact. And they invest millions of dollars in recruitment in high schools and also in video games that kind of condition and indoctrinate youth.
Parents usually encourage their children to go to college before selecting any career, particularly in the Army, contributing to the recruitment stumbles even further. It is becoming increasingly difficult for top military leaders to change the minds of the parents who work hard all their lives and have a dream of seeing their kids in college and consequently in respectable positions.
Well, I think it shows that Americans are starting to see the distinction between the U.S. empire and military apparatus and the real United States where we live and work. The empire has provided Americans with some temporal benefits as our economy profits off the exploitation of other countries. But ultimately, it has created an inflated bureaucracy that isn't helping out the American people at this point in time, as we can see when we're sending millions and billions to Ukraine, to Israel, while we don't even have health care at home.
A U.S. Army study in 2021 found that 75% of Americans aged 16 to 28 know little or nothing about how the Army works, showing an erosion of trust, not just in the Army, but in all of American institutions. How do foreign nations perceive the U.S. Army's role in the international order, considering the atrocities that soldiers and military contractors have committed?
The U.S. has, yeah, really had a shameful record over the past two generations. Well, certainly, I mean, I think in the Vietnam era, you know, I think in those years, the U.S. military developed a horrible reputation because incidents like the My Lai massacre were exposed before most of the world how the U.S. really behaves when they invade other countries, which is like other invaders. You know, Americans promoted this idea of American exceptionalism, that America was different from other world powers and empires and behaved more civilly. But then that myth was punctured with incidents like the My Lai massacre in Vietnam and then the Abu Ghraib incident in Iraq and, as you say, other atrocities that have been exposed and other morally bankrupt interventions where the pretext behind the war has been shown to be fraudulent.
The U.S. military sector's solution to tackle the recent shortfalls has been to spend even more money to lure young men and women into the Army. Thousands of dollars are being spared to persuade young adults to get enlisted, and even more, cash of up to $35,000 is allocated to recruits in certain sectors where shortfalls are more serious.
Yet, as anti-war sentiments grow across the United States and the rest of the world, recruiting fit soldiers appears to be a grave challenge for the Pentagon. Experiences and memories of war veterans from battlefields in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Vietnam are also playing a key role in dissuading the young generation to pursue a career in the military.
While the U.S. media and government, you know, puts out some constant propaganda to justify our foreign inventions, at this point, it's kind of just putting lipstick on a pig. The American people witnessed the humiliation of America's exit for Afghanistan, of the just catastrophe of the so-called war on terror. You know, it might not be entirely what everyone might not readily admit that the claim of WMDs was a lie, but many, many do realize that and know that they were fooled for many years.
With only over 3 months left in the fiscal year 2022, the U.S. Army has reportedly met just around 40% of its enlisted recruiting mission. That represents a military fiasco in need of urgent attention from the highest-ranking officials. It is not clear yet whether monetary incentives are enough to encourage the youth to consider a military career.
I think the veneer is running more and more thin with recent disasters, and especially as that impacts the U.S. economy more and more, as the price of oil goes up, as the geopolitical landscape shifts, as China supersedes the U.S. economically, many Americans question the policies adopted by their government, and they're demanding change. And if the government doesn't respond in a positive way or constructive way, you're going to see more and more incidents like the January 6th riot, where there are riots on the Capitol and street fights surrounding elections, and you know, angry masses who are either descending on the Capitol or turning on each other. So I think it's a dangerous environment right now in the United States.
Now, the U.S. failure to recruit young adults is part of a bigger problem in America, which involves weakening institutions and all the internal sectors, as well as overseas malfunctioning of the U.S. as a superpower. Now, considering U.S. Army's global performance, how much does pursuing a career in the military contribute to the sense of pride and patriotism for Americans as a nation?
Well, I believe that Americans are largely patriotic and exceptionalist toward America and view the U.S. as the superior nation to most. May still believe that we have the most freedom, that we have the best basis of our government. But this patriotism among Americans, I don't think, is any longer rooted in the U.S. Army's recent, especially global performance, especially for young people. I think that older generations, they might still feel pride in what they saw as Cold War victories against communism or totalitarianism. But young people, we've only witnessed the catastrophe of the wars on Iraq and Afghanistan. And the U.S. government and media, they rely on creating our patriotism and pride in our nation and in our military with propaganda.
With war in Ukraine and the U.S. attempts to bolster NATO to take on Russia's influence in the Eastern Europe, the need for a stronger military is felt more than ever in recent times. The reported shortfall in the army, however, could present yet another obstacle for the U.S. military forces to function overseas.
Well, the U.S. has found a way to wage wars kind of on the cheap, you know, relying more on drones and special forces and high-tech, bombing and armaments, or wars by proxy like we see in Ukraine, where the U.S. essentially is a co-belligerent in the war, shipping a huge amount of weaponry to the Ukrainians and providing special forces. But they're not going to send U.S. ground troops. So I think, you know, that's one way to offset the lower recruitment and the lack of support on middle to, you know, middle upper class and upper class people in America are not sending their kids into the military to fight in these wars.
The dark history of the U.S. military's brutality appears to be ultimately portrayed among the masses in the United States. But generally speaking, how is the reputation of U.S. military forces evaluated at home?
I think that those propaganda campaigns like Top Gun, I think they have, they might get some people excited temporarily, but I really think it's fleeting. It's not really a replacement for, a real good foreign policy. But I do think that Americans generally respect and admire those who serve in the military and would be reluctant to identify any individuals, even, you know, officers or generals in the military as anything but, you know, respectable servants who sacrifice for America, and that the U.S. military is still seen as deserving support. But there is absolutely distrust of the military-industrial complex, politicians who lie to send our kids to war, and war profiteers. I don't think that any of that is out of the view of an ordinary American.
Skilled, relevant, and innovative talents are headed in the opposite direction by applying for jobs in the private sector instead. In the meanwhile, the Pentagon's top leaders have no other solution than enticing the youths by pitching the benefits of enlisting. And now it's time we check in with Abbas Mutarim to see what he has prepared for us this week.
Peace, and welcome back to Power to the People. On today's episode, we will take a look at the current state of the U.S. military and, by default, capitalist imperialism. First and foremost, and we must understand that the so-called United States military must be understood as the armed protectors and aggressors of the capitalist imperialist empire. And the American military, it is the biggest threat to humanity. It's the biggest threat that humanity has ever known and is responsible for crimes against humanity and genocidal conditions. It literally has been in a perpetual state of war since it was founded, killing indigenous people and Africans to create the so-called settler country. And since the end of World War II, the so-called United States, they have intervened in 60 plus countries using a variety of tactics, and this doesn't even include clandestine operations that are still classified. It's very clear that America's military, it has blood on its hands, and it is a manifestation of the devil himself. And even though the U.S., it is considered to have one of the strongest militaries in the world, countries like Iraq and Afghanistan have fought back to remove U.S. military colonizers from their land. And countries like Iran and Cuba, they have been under inhumane sanctions and have remained steadfast. And these must be understood as victories against the U.S. military machine. And this must be understood as victory for oppressed people. And it shows us that the U.S. regime, it can and will be defeated.
And if we look closely at the USA's most recent big conflict, which is the US/NATO/Ukraine versus Russia war, it shows us that the Western-backed Ukraine is losing to Russia. The results of this war so far show us that a multipolar world is being developed where the capitalist imperialist military regime of the United States is being challenged. We must understand that one of the main functions of the US capitalist imperialist machine is to wage war and make profits, which it undoubtedly has done, as American oil corporations have made billions from this conflict in Ukraine. And US capitalist imperialism, it is also using, one of the tactics is to use genocidal sanctions against countries, which is another form of military warfare, in an attempt to starve countries that wish to be free from imperialism into submission. This is done to keep capitalist imperialism at the top and to make the world subjected to the rules of the so-called American capitalism. And while the USA, they have made massive profits, there's no doubt about that, it has also taken major losses from this warfare, as in many ways, what has happened with sanctions has backfired against good old Uncle Sam. These sanctions are done to keep capitalist imperialism at the top and to make the world subjected to the rules of American capitalism. And while the USA has undoubtedly made massive profits from this war, it has also taken major losses, as in many ways, what has happened with sanctions has backfired against Uncle Sam. And if we look at the so-called American economy, inflation is at an all-time high. It went up 9.1%, which is the biggest yearly increase since 1981. And while, of course, the elites in the capitalist imperialist economy are making massive profits, it can also be said and argued that Russia has been winning this clash with US capitalist imperialism. This materially counteracts the capitalist imperialist goal of complete world domination and control, and it shows us again that a multipolar world is here. And in the face of this development of this new world order, the so-called United States military is in a recruiting crisis and is struggling to meet its quotas. This has led to the US military dropping GED and high school graduation requirements being waived, as well as some other requirements. And people are even denying the large sign-on bonuses of the US military. And this might be seen as a sign of weakening US nationalism and perhaps an emerging anti-war movement that is starting in the belly of the imperialist beast. But whatever happens, it's very clear that a new world order is being birthed as we speak. And it provides hope for oppressed people everywhere suffering from the imperialist beast of the so-called United States of America. But one thing must be for certain is that imperialism itself will not self-destruct. It must be defeated and it must be crushed. We are always our own liberators. This is Power to the People.
I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and make sure to tune in next time when we return with another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The Last Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. I am your host, Zainab. Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, said, "The man who does not know the Imam of his time will die the death of an ignorant." But in this program, we try to make sure that you get the maximum information about the Imam of your time. Today, to discuss about Mahdaviyat, to discuss more on du'as, we have with us in studio Dr. Karimi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So Dr. Karimi, in our previous sessions, you provided us with the information of the titles given to Imam in the Ziyarat Ali Yasin, which we're one or the other way, giving us the concept of monotheism, taking us back to Allah, showing that even Imams that we, which we highly regard, are the servants of Allah. And the thing that you mentioned in the previous session, you explained the titles given to Imam one by one, which kind of gives us the ma'rifat towards Imam, gives us the knowledge towards Imam, which is the very first and foremost duties of believers. We would definitely want to get knowing more about.
The first part of the dua consists of more than 20 salams and greetings to the Imam. And these greetings, half of them are about the titles of the Imam, Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance. I referred to some of the titles in the previous session. And the second part is about the different estates of the Imam or different times. Let me just refer to some of them. One of them is, As-salamu alayka hina taqumu wa taq'ud. Peace be upon you when you stand up and when you sit down. So one interpretation of this part is that so there are two estates of the Imam, when he is standing and when he is sitting. But another deep understanding of this part of dua, which is a kind of salam, is that taqumu, standing, is referring to the uprising of the Imam, and taq'ud, it is referring to the time before the uprising of the Imam, that is the time of the major occultation. And again, it has message to us. It doesn't make any difference whether the Imam is sitting, like he's during the major occultation, or he's standing, he's doing his uprising. In both cases, he is our Imam.
All right. The concept gets clear that Imam is not Imam when he gets reappeared. Imam is like performing his duties even if he's in major occultation right now.
Exactly. And with that, let me refer to the famous narration of our Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family. It's been mentioned in both Shia and Sunni collections of hadith that Hassan and Hussein are the Imams.
All right.
Qama aw qa'ada, whether they are standing or sitting, whether one of them is doing uprising, referring to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
All right.
It is because of the fact that at that time it was the duty of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam to have his uprising.
All right.
Or whether he is standing, like coming to a peace treaty, referring to Imam al-Hassan.
Wow, so we just need to not concentrate only on the lexical meaning of the hadiths. We need to go behind some content, what the hadith is trying to say, some hidden meaning behind those words.
Yeah, unfortunately, especially when we refer to some narrations in non-Shia collections of hadiths, they try to give a different picture out of Imam al-Hassan alayhi salam and Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
Right.
But as for the Shia, we believe in the fact that they are what we call it Nur and Wahid, the same light.
Yes.
So the conditions at the time of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam require that he come to a peace treaty imposed to him, of course, with Muawiyah. And the conditions at the time of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam required him to have that uprising.
Yes. So Dr. Karimi, I'll be back on this session with you after a very short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. We're discussing about Bethawiyat. We are discussing about the du'as, and today we are discussing about the content of Ziyarat Ali Yasin. Yes, Dr. Karimi, you said that even if in the time of major occultation, Imam is carrying out his responsibilities.
Yeah, and there are some other salams when, in which we refer to other states of the Imam, like when he's saying his prayer, when he's going to ruku', bowing down and sajda, prostration, when he says different adhkar, like La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar, when he praises God, and different times, like in the morning and at night. Then we begin to talk about the different Islamic beliefs.
All right.
And maybe this part is the most important part of Ziyara Ali Yasin, because in it, somehow we are repeating all the Islamic beliefs that we have. We begin by saying that we believe in oneness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We reject any partner for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes.
We witness to the prophethood of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his family. We refer to the fact that we love the Prophet and his progeny. We explicitly mention that we believe in the imamate of all the 12 Imams, beginning with Imam Ali alayhi salam and ending with Imam Mahdi. May Allah hasten his reappearance. And then other Islamic beliefs.
Yes.
Now, like Dua will add here, we say that we do believe in the concept of raj'ah or return. We have already talked about that, so I don't want to repeat.
Yes.
Also, there are many indications about the hereafter. We say that we believe in the concept of death, in the fact that Nakir and Munkar will come to us in the grave. Nakir and Munkar are those two angels which come to the people in the grave when they are buried and ask them about fundamental Islamic beliefs. According to some narrations, they are called Nakir and Munkar if they come to bad people like disbelievers. But for good people, for righteous people, for the believers, they are called Bashir and Mubashir. In Ziyara Ali Yasin, we also witness that we believe in the hereafter, we believe in the concept of Sirat, which is called a kind of bridge over the hill. All the people need to pass on it.
Yes.
And if they pass, then they will go to the paradise. There are many explanations, whether it is symbolic or real. We are not going to talk about that. We talked about different concepts which are related to the Day of Judgment, like the scales, like the fact that our actions will be taken into account.
Yes.
The concept of paradise and hellfire. This is the second part of Ziyara Ali Yasin. In the third part, somehow we refer to our connection and relation to Imam Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance,
inshallah.
We say that, oh my Imam, whoever is opposing you, they would be wretched people, and those who follow you, they are happy people. Please bear witness that I love you and I hate your enemies. The truth is what you approve of, and the falsehood is what you disagree with.
These lines remind me of Ziyarat Ashura as well.
Exactly. This is one of the most important part of this dua. According to some scholars, this is the peak of Ziyara Ali Yasin.
All right.
فَالْحَقُّ مَا رَضِيْتُمُ. Truth is what you are happy with.
All right.
وَالْبَاطُلُ مَا سَخِطْتُمُ. Falsehood is what you are against, what you are angry with. وَالْمَعْرُوفُ مَا أَمَرْتُمْ بِهِ. The good action is what you order to. وَالْمُنْكَرُ مَا نَهِيتُمْ عَنْ. And the bad action is what you ask the people to be away from. So why do I call this part as one of the most important parts of the dua? And as I mentioned, some scholars believe that this part is the peak of Ziyara Ali Yasin.
All right.
It is referring to the great status of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt. If we want to know the truth is Imam Ali alayhi salam. As the Holy Prophet said, Al-Haqqu ma'a Ali, wa Aliyun ma'a al-Haq. If you want to know the criterion for the truth, the criterion is Imam. If you know the Imam, then whatever Imam believes in is the truth. Whatever Imam is ordering you, then this is the truth. If Imam is asking you to be away from a special actions, then this is the truth, whatever he says. So for us as the believers, فَالْحَقُّ مَا رَضِيْتُمُ. The truth is what Imam is happy with. The truth is what Imam approves of. وَالْبَاطُلُ مَا سَخِطْتُمُ. And the falsehood is what the Imams are against that. as I mentioned, this is referring in one way to the famous narration of the Prophet that Al-Haqqu Ma'a Ali has been mentioned in different Shia and Sunni collections of hadith, like Al-Kafi by Sheikh Quraini, volume 1, page 294, and also in Mafatihul Ghaib by Fakhruddin al-Razi, volume 1, page